This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. At the Utah legislative session this year, Representative Angela Romero is trying to get some money, about $40,000, to create a task force that would look into a mystifying issue in the United States, this alarming number of indigenous women and girls who have gone missing or are being killed. And here's what I mean. In 2016, according to the National Crime Information Center, there were more than 5,700 cases of indigenous women and girls either killed or abducted. But of that, only 116 of those cases were logged in a Department of Justice database. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention reports murder as the third leading cause of death among indigenous women in this country, and the rates of violence on reservations is in some places 10 times higher than the national average. Now, those numbers are startling, but the truth is we don't actually know the real numbers. There's no reliable count, no real accounting for why. And the reasons are complicated. They go way back. This is an issue informed and shaped by history. Today in the program, we're talking about just what is happening to Native women and girls in this country and why the crimes against them are being neglected or forgotten. Joining us first on the program is Graham Lee Brewer. He's a contributing editor at High Country News, a member of the Cherokee Nation. He's joining us from the radio station KGOU in Norman, Oklahoma. That's where he's based. And Graham Lee Brewer, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thank you so much for having me.
I guess I wanted to begin with such an obvious question, Graham. What is going on? Give us a sense of the scope of this problem. I mean, we'll get into why it's happening and why it's difficult to report on and talk about. But what is your sense of what's happening?
Well, it's kind of like you set up in the intro there that it is a huge problem, and there are thousands of cases, but we don't really have a good understanding of how large the problem is. And that's due to a variety of reasons. One is that there's a complicated patchwork of federal jurisdiction in Indian country.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, here in Oklahoma, Indian country has a very different definition in a legal sense and in a cultural sense. Only one tribe, the Osage Nation, technically has a reservation here. So our jurisdiction laws can be complicated compared to other parts of the country. They can also depend on how strong cross-deputization programs between local law enforcement and tribal law enforcement is. It's very good to have a tribal input, especially on the law enforcement angle, for a variety of cultural reasons that can compound the problem. All of that is also compounded by the fact that sometimes these victims, and not really sometimes, a lot of the time, the victims, there's not an importance placed on them. So we talk about victims of the same crimes differently depending on their race and background. And that's not just evident in a variety of ways we've seen play out in as our national dialogue, I think, evolves in recent years. But this is especially a problem in Indian country because of invisibility of those communities. They're not understood. They're not covered in ethical and responsible ways by national press, and they're not treated with equal value by the justice system.
Yeah. So it's interesting. One of the things, I mean, you've been writing about this for a while now, but people, I mean, we're just doing a show now about all of this. Like, what do you make of that? That it's being perceived as this kind of, I mean, I think you've described it as a new media phenomenon, talking about something that's been going on for a long time.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this not too long ago. I wrote an op-ed for High Country News. I think it's been a couple of years now, about the problem of missing and murdered indigenous women and girls, and really kind of like the legislative backlog, the lack of accountability on local and national levels. And I remember that piece got a lot of attention, and I remember feeling like confused by that because I didn't really feel like I had added anything new to the discussion. I was actually a little bit disappointed in the op-ed just because I was kind of frustrated by the fact that it was hard to find ways to add any new information to it. At least that was from my perspective. And then I think stepping back, I kind of realized, well, I think the reason that article got so much attention was because it was such a new thing to so many people.
Yeah.
And that is a very typical problem when it comes to covering Indian country overall. I'm also a board member at the Native American Journalists Association, and we're very we take a lot of time to look at how the media discusses Indian country and the emphasis and importance that certain stories get and others don't. And like I said, this is a pretty pervasive problem across all issues of Indian country, that they aren't given very much, I guess, you know, fair representation. Yeah. There's not a lot of thorough discussions. A lot of stereotype and myth are incorporated in those discussions. And you know, that the missing and murdered indigenous women story is becoming so much more like a bigger part of the media coverage of Indian country recently. I think it also kind of sometimes puts this emphasis on violence when it comes to being Indian. And it gives people this false perception that violence is an intrinsic part of these places, that these reservations are dangerous. That's not the way that I hear Indian people describe the reservations.
Because the perpetrators, most of them are white. I mean, that is the myth that you hear from time and time again, that there's violence going on in the reservation. It seems like that's why people are neglecting this story, because they think it's just going on among Native people, when in fact, as you say, the perpetrators here are mostly white.
Yeah, I think a lot of the early coverage, that isn't really even that old. A lot of the time, it fails to point out the fact that, you know, according to the Department of Justice's own statistics, the majority of Native people say the majority. 60% of Native victims describe their attacker as white, when you leave that part of the context out, it gives the false perception that like violence is this endemic, intrinsic part of life there.
Yeah.
Sarah Deer, the researcher, one of the leading researchers on this topic, I think points to that effect a lot. That it affects the language that we use. We say, "Well, who was this? Who was she running around with? Was she drinking?" You know, and we find ways to blame the victims for the violence that happens to them.
You mentioned that this gets at this complicated jurisdictional maze, but you say that the law really won't allow tribes to prosecute non-Native people, which has described sort of a situation that you've explained is like a hunting ground for perpetrators.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost by design. I mean, I think, you know, you have to consider the fact that this country was founded on genocide and you know, white settlement and colonialism. And so it's not very surprising to me that these things haven't been addressed even to this day, because some of them are built by design to not address the problems of certain people. And so, yes, it's created this difficult patchwork of jurisdiction. Simplify it in a way, essentially, if it's a crime involving a Native person on Native lands, then it falls into federal jurisdiction, because technically those are federal lands.
Yeah.
And I'd say about half of those cases are declined for prosecution by federal prosecutors for a variety of reasons. But that leads to a staggering number of cases that are never really fully investigated.
Well, one of the things you've written about, there's this provision in the law that was adopted back, I think it was in 2013, which did give tribal governments a bit more authority to prosecute non-natives on tribal land. But the laws that they can prosecute don't include a lot of crimes, like crimes against children, sexual assault crimes, crimes committed by strangers. That seems baffling to me.
Yeah, most of the crimes that are prosecuted through tribal courts are misdemeanors or lower level felonies. My tribe, for instance, the Cherokee Nation, a lot of what the Cherokee Nation Court in Tahlequah, Oklahoma does is adoption cases that deal with the Indian Child Welfare Act, which is a very important piece of federal legislation that defines who can adopt Indian children. But yeah, you're right. I mean, just going and sitting in a typical day in the Cherokee Nation court, you'll see a lot of, you know, property damage cases, things like that. But when it comes to murder, rape, acts of violence, those are typically handled by federal prosecutors. Now, there are instances where federal prosecutors are working very closely with tribal attorneys, and there are tribal attorneys who work with the federal government, that are paid to work with the federal government and advise them on the intricacies of federal Indian law, which is very complicated.
Yeah.
And here in Oklahoma, some of the federal prosecutors are tribal citizens themselves. And so that, you know, lends this extra expertise, a way to understand how to navigate cross-deputization programs and work together to, you know, none of the people involved, whether it's the federal government or the tribal governments, want criminals to run unfettered in their districts. Yeah. But the way that the law has been established makes it difficult to work together sometimes.
There's one thing I wanted to ask you about. You've written about that if tribes want to be able to prosecute these more serious crimes, they may have to give up a bit of sovereign authority, like allowing, you say, non-tribal citizens to serve on juries. Mm-hmm. Is that an obstacle here?
I think so. I mean, it is in a cultural sense. I think that a lot of what can get missed in the discussions about federal law, too, are just the differences in culture and governing structures and the history and legacy of how those things came to be. So, yeah, I mean, I think philosophically it is hard for some people to be okay with the idea that non-Cherokee people could sit on a jury that involves a Cherokee case. You know, there is a long history of distrust between Native communities and outside communities, and that I think is well established and understandable for sure. And so sometimes, it's complicated looking past that or finding ways to get around it, I guess, for lack of a better word.
You have described this, Graham, as a legacy of colonialism, and it's one of the things we're going to be spending a bit more time on a little bit later on the program, the historical component of this. Do you get a sense that people think about this in broader ways? Certainly, I think Native people do, for sure, but I'm mm-hmm. thinking about the federal authorities, state authorities. Are they thinking about the kind of the historical roots for all of this, and is that necessary to really come to grips with what's actually happening?
I think that's a great question. To answer it shortly, no, I don't think that those people are thinking those things as much as they should. And I think that is also another problem that is by design. You know, I grew up here in Norman, Oklahoma. I would argue that Norman, while Oklahoma is an exceedingly red state, Norman is one of the most progressive places here. And in my high school history class, we started Oklahoma history with the land run, effectively erasing hundreds of tribal communities that pre-existed the state or were forced here otherwise through the Trail of Tears. And so I don't think that I don't blame people for not knowing that problem because, you know, our public school system, quite frankly, doesn't want us to spend much time on that. And so, no, I don't think most people really understand the – not even just those complexities, but I mean just like the basic components of Indian life, what citizenship means, what sovereignty is, what a Native person quote-unquote should look like. These are all very, very complicated, nuanced discussions I do see happening more and more. But in terms of driving policy, I don't think that it was a big part of policy discussions until the media started trying to make it a bigger part of the discussion. And quite frankly, we started electing Indian people into into positions where they can create laws.
Yeah. Or in the case of Angela Romero, people of color, it seems like they have this awareness that others might not.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to meet Representative Romero last year and speak with her. I think that she even her own she will even tell you that even her own personal background is very complicated.
Right.
But it also is very misunderstood.
It's interesting in Canada to just compare and contrast what's going on in Canada about all of this and what's going on in the United States. I mean, one of the things is they had this truth and reconciliation process. And I know it's not perfect. I know there are still issues there, of course, but I wondered if something like that could happen in the United States or if there's a resistance by the culture here, the predominant culture here, to really talk about the past and take responsibility for the problem.
I mean, I certainly think that it could. And I would certainly say that there are many aspects of how it played out in Canada that are problematic, which isn't very surprising. But yeah. I do think that there is a bit of a resistance here. And I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, so one of the things I do for the Native American Journal Association is I go to newsrooms and I train them how to ethically and responsibly cover Indian country. I've done it at KUER. A lot of instances remind reporters that when I'm taking a piece of your work and I'm being critical of it and I'm showing you how I think you could have done better for this Native community, it's not personal. Yeah. Like this isn't a personal attack. The public education system failed you. Government failed you. They robbed me and you of our histories. And I think that it takes time to deconstruct some of those narratives that we have been falsely given. And that's a process. It's one that myself as an Indigenous person am still doing to this day, and I will do probably for the rest of my professional career. I think that is just, that's a very, very, very common way to approach the problem, I think, is that thinking things like, well, I didn't do that, it was my ancestors.
Yeah.
And then we see it play out in things like the state of Oklahoma, for instance, just recently did a rebrand. They have a new logo and a new slogan. And some of the literature behind building that new logo was about how this state was created in a flash by pioneers. And of course, all of us Indigenous people here are like, hey, come on now. Like, we're a huge part of this state. Like, we are the reason you're here.
We're essentially out of time, but you sound a little hopeful that some of these task forces might get us beyond the mark.
Happy to see these discussions happening and being more robust and offering ways for accountability.
Graham Lee Brewer, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
He's a contributing editor at High Country News, member of the Cherokee Nation, joined us from radio station KGOU in Norman, Oklahoma. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
On the latest episode of Preach, what happens when your dad, who also happens to be your priest, says it is not your destiny to play football?
I was looking at him like, come on, man.
Like, you didn't feel like God was saying it to you?
No, of course not, man. I was staring my dad in the face. How could this not be for me is what I'm thinking. Y'all tell me follow my dreams. I can't follow my dreams and not play football.
Find Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. There's a bill making its way through the Utah legislature trying to make sense of this as a modern problem. A number of states are creating these task forces. But as we've heard, to really get at what's going on, you have to understand that this is more than just a jurisdictional question. There's also a difficult history that you have to wrestle with, and that is playing a big part in this story. Karina Walters is an enrolled member of the Choctaw Nation. She is the Catherine Hall Chambers Scholar in the School of Social Work at the University of Washington, where she's also the director and principal investigator of the Indigenous Wellness Research Institute. And she joined us recently to explain that this violence against Native American women and children goes back generations.
This isn't a new phenomenon. The history goes all the way back to Columbus and first contact, when Columbus was here and his goal was primarily land, gold, and slaves. Even on his second voyage, that was the explicit charge, was to get gold and slaves. And what was different about Native American slavery compared to African slavery in the earlier times is that Native slavery, the target were primarily women and children. If you think about most of the tribes along the eastern seaboard were primarily matrilineal and matriarchal, which meant that the land and the political processes and the cultural processes were tied to women's status. So if you can break down the women and you can break down the children, then you can get access to land much more quickly.
Yeah. Say more about that, because one of the things you said is the way this works, the way this so-called colonial project has worked is – one of the things you've mentioned is erasing indigeneity, this idea of removing people, physically removing them from their land, physically removing them from their resources. Talk about the effect of that, because the impact is crucial.
I mean, the two goals of settler colonialism is land, acquiring land.
Yeah.
It's always about land. I can tell you right now, it's definitely about land.
Right.
And it's to erase the indigeneity tied to that land. Because when you can erase the indigeneity, either through genocide – or through what I call ethnocide, which is the systematic destruction of culture and lifeways, and even epistemicide, right? Trying to do the boarding school project, which was trying to get us to not be native anymore, speak our language, yeah. or things yeah. like that. If we don't exist in the minds of the people anymore, then somehow it justifies being able to take land. It justifies a narrative, a manifest destiny. Mm-hmm. That land is open and now we can just take it because it wasn't being used well anyways. You know, those kinds of narratives.
Yeah.
When in fact we were incredible societies that were here and that still remain.
Explain how this shapes the life of indigenous people to be removed from physical resources, from removed from, and it must disconnect them from their identity. So this must be the trauma that we're not quite able to understand the depth of here, I'm guessing.
Right. So a lot of us and scholars in our community, we also talk about it as historical trauma, right? So historical trauma is not like typical trauma where you have like a hurricane that blows in and it can have intergenerational effects, you know, causes great upheaval, great stress, and it could be felt for generations. What's different about historical trauma is it's man-made. It's targeting directly a people with the intention of eradicating them, either through culture or literally through genocide. And so that effect can be very huge. It's held collectively, right, for the community that experienced it. What we look at in terms of our research and the work that I do is we're trying to better understand, you know, how does that get transformed or transferred over generations? And there's some research now that kind of still controversial and still unfolding, but some epigenetic research that looks like you can see that stress is actually transmitted over generations at literally at the cellular level. Now, just because people have experienced that, though, doesn't mean everyone does poorly.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, I think, you know, ways that communities have survived or ways that people have kept their culture alive or their spirituality went underground to be protected so that it can come above ground at a time when it's ready. Those kinds of survival strategies were really key to helping our societies continue. And the reality is, you know, we maintained a lot of our sovereignty. We can look at what's happening in different parts of Canada as well as here in the United States where communities are saying, well, this is unceded territory. We have not given up this land. This is not, you know, yours to take. And so, you know, our communities are still alive and well despite having those kinds of traumatic experiences.
Mm. I suppose this is also an issue. I mean, I guess this goes without saying for African-American culture as well, that intergenerational trauma is also at play mm-hmm. there as well, I suppose.
Absolutely. And they've had their own historical trauma experiences, right?
Yeah.
So it's manifest differently for different communities. But we also had slavery and we had stolen land. But, you know, African-Americans in terms of literally being stolen from their land and displaced and put into this country. But one thing that I could say that some of our research and there's other research that are showing that there are actual intergenerational mental health effects. So for example, in one of my studies, we recently You know, the big argument, the debate is, well, maybe what we're capturing in our research is really, you know, contemporary trauma, you know, sexual assault or military combat exposure. There's other kinds of things that would cause post-traumatic stress disorder, right?
Right.
And so what we do is the best we can is we basically did an analysis looking at across four generations of the different kinds of traumatic experiences people may have experienced. And then what we asked was what were their contemporary lived experiences of trauma? So statistically, what we do is we then isolate that to see once we remove contemporary traumas, lifetime sexual assault, for example, lifetime combat exposure, once we take all those out, do we still have an effect of these previous generations' historically traumatic experiences on contemporary mental health? And what we're finding is, yes, that's true for post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's not surprising given that we have such high – our rates are double in terms of PTSD to the general population. About 7% of our population has diagnosable PTSD.
So that, what's so, I think, compelling about that is that if you deal with what might be the contemporary component of that
mm-hmm. –
okay, you get – and not that that ever is entirely healed, but let's say you at least to start to deal with that. How do you deal with the generational part, the historical oppression that's embedded in somebody? Have you even thought about that part of it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, there's three elements that we always talk about in the work that we do in our communities. Is the purpose of historical trauma is to cause disruptions in relational ways of being, whether to the land, to your body, to your way of thinking, your culture. So part of the goal of any kind of therapeutic approach, whether collectively or at the individual level, is to regenerate that. And the way we start to do that is we build our interventions based on our original teachings, because we have teachings about how to be healthy and well from our point of view, right? And then the second thing is restoring our relational way of being. You know, how do we understand ourselves in relation to each other and our body, our culture, our world? And the third element is always decolonizing how we think about ourselves and how we talk about ourselves so that we're talking from a place of health and well-being.
I was so taken with something you said. I wrote this down. We don't start with the trauma. We've got to start with the beauty and the original instructions.
Absolutely. I can give you an example of that. I was working in a community and I was brought in to actually talk about obesity prevention in the community. And we were dealing with very young children who were already diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, 8, 9, 10 years old. And I was new to this community, so I was not from that community. Even though I'm a Native woman, I wasn't of their community. And I walked in the door, and I'll never forget, there was like 10 or 11 grandmas sitting at the table, and that already is scary.
Right.
You know? And I walked in, and I sat down, and the first thing when the grandma said, she stood up and she said, "Don't you be sending any of those skinny white people in here to talk to us about our weight and our body. You know, we've always had different body types. You know, that's how we are. So don't be bringing that in here." And that told me something really important. One is grandmas were going to throw down for their children, which was to be respected.
Yeah.
And that me, even as an outsider, even though I'm Native, that I need to be careful about what I bring into the story and what I bring into the room. And so I wanted to honor that. But that told me a third thing, which is, how did this narrative come about? Because I looked at previous photos of that community, and they were very lean. So it was really interesting to hear that the narrative is, we've always been big.
Yeah.
Our babies have always been big. And that's when I have the aha, how is historical trauma at work here? So I asked the community, I asked the grandmas there, and I said, you know, tell me a little bit about, and this is where you start with the love when you talk about historical trauma. Tell me about your original instructions about how to live with the land and the food and, you know, those things that are tied, obviously, to obesity. And the grandmas took off and they told amazing stories to each other. And, you know, they'd say, oh, when this butterfly comes, we know to pick this berry kind of stories. And then they said, you know, we haven't passed that on to our kids enough, right? And so that opened up the next question, which was for historical trauma purposes, you know, how did that get disrupted? What disrupted your ability to fulfill your original teachings? And they're like, what do you mean? You know? And we pulled off a calendar off the wall. And I said, well, you know, your calendars always tell you each month what you should be doing in the environment, right? Mm-hmm. This is in my tribe, it's big hunger month, little hunger month, you know,
right.
The month of the, you know, mulberry, you know, it tells us what to do. And so then they took off and they talked about that. And I said, so what caused the disruption in that? And hands down, they all said, it's when we got removed to this reservation.
Mm.
And so then I asked the third element for the historical trauma work. I said, well, what happened when you moved there? Like, what made you not be able to pass on those stories or those experiences? And they said, well, we were not allowed to hunt. We were not allowed to fish. We were given a bag of flour, which we thought was poison, which kind of ironically is, right?
Yeah.
Now in this generation, we know that. And so we starved. We went through a great starvation. And then this is the final element, is what did your ancestors do to survive, to make sure that you were here? And they said, oh, well, we made sure our children ate first. And our biggest babies, they always survived.
Mm.
And then the aha happens. Because now we're not having a conversation that being big is about being cultural, but rather being big was a historical trauma survival response. And, you know, and then we said, well, is that working now? Let's honor that. That's what your grandmas and grandpas did because they had to. But is that working now? And how is that playing out in our family and our communities now? And then they tell stories about hoarding food or feeling like you have to eat everything on your plate. And that rolled in the issue of boarding school and feeling like you never had enough food when they went to boarding school, which was, you know, the cumulative traumatic events, right? These aren't never one-offs, isolated events. There's usually several that happen in across generations. And so I said, you know, now we've got a great opportunity, right? You dealt with starvation, and now we're dealing with obesity. And it's really the flip side of the same coin. It's both malnutrition. And so now you've got a really beautiful, powerful place to be where you can decide what's going to happen now for the next 8 generations or 7 generations for your grandkids. And they took off. They did their own thing, you know.
Yeah.
But all I did was just try to open up the conversation to move it away from it. This is a cultural normative practice to, hey, is it? Or is this a kind of a cultural trauma response? And do we want to look at that? So this is really about not being a place of victimization. So I really want – gosh, I really want to be clear on that. Historical trauma isn't about being a victim. It's actually about power, love, and vision. Mm-hmm. And that's how I see it, that we have the opportunity in this instant to actually take action that is empowering the next 7 generations, right? So that example I just gave, now it's about power. It's not about being disempowered.
Well, resilience is a big thing for you, right? I mean, and it seems like that is the – I have to say, in a story that for a lot of us seems entirely hopeless, this is a very hopeful part of it, that you have these communities themselves are starting to make these connections, or maybe always made the connections, but now starting to act on these connections.
Yeah.
That seems like a good sign.
Oh, I think it's fantastic. I think across the country, you know, I think we've always been resilient. And I don't mean resilient in kind of the Bobo doll experience resilience, right, where you knock it down and it just gets up to get knocked down again. I think that our communities have gone on to say, you know, I can't wait around for the government to fix us. And that's part of the first step of decolonization, to say, hey, we need to do this for ourselves because our ancestors already knew how to do this. So how do we grow that?
Yeah. I don't want to shift away from that hopeful insight, but I do want to because we have to talk about this, and that is the role or the continuing role of white culture, of American culture in all of this. What do you mean, Professor, when you say the colonial project is unfinished?
Yeah. Well, Eve Tuck actually originally said that, and I want to acknowledge that. You know, part of the reason why people get anxious talking about this, we've all grown up in a society being told certain historical narrative about the United States that is patriotic. And designed to feel pride, right? Feel prideful that this is an amazing country and we should all be proud. And
all of our gains were gained fairly.
It was totally fair. Yeah. And, you know, the country really – and, you know, kind of the Native people, you know, they weren't really using this land. So now it's justified taking over, right? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that goes all the way back to the doctrine of discovery. So, I mean, that's a long European kind of point of view that was imported here onto this land. But what makes it complicated is because we've all been sold the story that when we start to raise questions about that story and we start to challenge narrative, you have natural anxiety that arises. Everyone feels it. And Eve Tuck calls it white settler anxiety. And there's moves to innocence. There's ways of trying to step aside from wrestling with that anxiety. Because all of a sudden it's like, well, what do I do with that information now? You know, how do I reconcile my love of country and, wow, we've done all this, you know? But I think that anxiety is healthful. I actually think it's good because it gives us an opportunity to change and to move in an honest direction.
Is that forward. What you mean, Professor, but when you say we need to pay attention to our ghosts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we don't, they haunt us. And they can make us sick. If I take a real more traditional point of view, if you don't pay attention to those things, they can make you sick. And right now we are a sick society around not having addressed, you know, any of that, whether it's chattel slavery, stealing of indigenous land, not honoring treaties or sovereignty. But we have systems in place that allow us to do that.
What does it look like, or would it look like for American white culture, for Americans to truly deal with this historical depression? I mean, if part of the problem was stripping them physically away from physical resources and land, how do you fully heal if you can't or don't physically reconnect them with that?
Honoring tribal sovereignty first and foremost is critical. So really listen to your local tribal communities, including the indigenous elders that don't necessarily represent tribal government. You need all of those points of view at the table.
Yeah.
But you do need to honor the treaties. You do need to honor the sovereignty. But you also need to honor people's rights to their land and their resources that are attached to that land and that they still have rights to. I think at the more local level, it's not enough to do land acknowledgements. That's kind of the new cool thing to do. I think that's important. That's helping to make visible the invisible. Better than that, go do something. You know, get to know your local Native community and what are their needs. And how can you commit to supporting that community's well-being? That's where decolonization really isn't a metaphor. You know, we don't need symbolic love. What we need is to have our treaties and our land and our cultural rights, spiritual rights respected.
Karina Walters is a member of the Choctaw Nation, a professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Washington, where she leads the Indigenous Wellness Research Institute. She joined us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
If you recently bought a new car, and now you're wondering what to do with the other one that's been hibernating in your garage all winter, consider donating it to KUER. We'll handle all the towing, and you could receive a tax deduction. Whether it's running or not, your old vehicle can help fuel the programs you rely on, like Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and Radio West. To get started, visit KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Over the last few years, there's been this growing awareness of the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and children and girls. And as we've heard it before, this is a problem that has its roots in the very first contact between Europeans and Native Americans. But the scope of this very modern crisis remains a mystery. A bill making its way through the Utah legislature would create this task force to look into the issue. And so we're using that as an opportunity today to talk about just why it is that this is happening and what is happening exactly. Joining us now on the program is Yolanda Francisco Nez, a member of the Navajo Nation, the executive director of Restoring Ancestral Winds. That's a nonprofit advocacy group that seeks to eliminate sexual and domestic violence among Utah's Indigenous people. And welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug, for having us.
Rone Benali is also with us, a member of the Navajo Nation, the coordinator of policy and advocacy for Restoring Ancestral Winds. And Rone Benali, welcome to you.
Thank you, Doug.
Okay. I want to begin with just your impressions of what you're hearing so far on the conversation. It seems to be some sense, of course, at least in the conversation so far, that this is a deeply rooted issue. How are you thinking about it in sort of broad terms now?
All of the above are true. But let me tell you that today in modern history in the state of Utah, let's bring this home a little bit further. We have individual girls, women, members of the LGBTQ two-spirit community who are being impacted on a regular basis when it comes to violence against these individuals. The disproportionate rate that is evident base. I mean, we know that this is a major factor in people's quality of life for Indigenous populations, and it's time we talk about it.
Yeah. Why are we talking about it now, Moroni, do you think? I mean, it's been going on for some time.
Right. And I think the conversation nationally really kind of was sparked by a report that came out of the Urban Indian Health Institute out of Seattle, right, which is a report that surveyed 71 cities across the nation and logged the number of cases of murdered missing Indigenous people. And found that Salt Lake City was ranked fairly high in that.
Right. Eighth, I think, right?
Eighth, according to that report.
Right.
But I think that report sparked a national conversation, more so than any other work that was going on at the time. And it really coalesced a lot of the other organizations and advocacy groups that were working on this and really brought them together. And to the previous question, I think this issue is intractable. It's a large intractable problem, which the task force we're hoping will address, because each agency community have a different part of this larger crisis. And what I heard before, the groundwork about the conversation around colonialism,
yeah,
and what it did in terms of disruptions of community, of family, of relations, of between each other. All of those become key factors that elevate the type of risk that increases vulnerability which then creates them, which then creates someone as a target for this type of violence. And so all of that is necessary to understand, because in the work that we're doing, oftentimes people want a very clear legal perpetrator, as if though capturing that one will address the larger crisis. And we're saying no.
It's more complicated.
It's more complicated than that. Absolutely.
So what are you finding with in your conversations with lawmakers trying to get some money for this task force? Is there an acknowledgement that this is deeper, or is it – I mean, because a lot of times I have to say politicians are interested in, you know, crime, dealing with crime. They're not maybe this is not fair, but they're not always entirely interested in the deeper rooted questions here. What are you finding?
Well, Moroni's been spending a lot of time at the current session, and I will have to say that we are incredibly hopeful for this HB 116 that is currently passing through, just past the House of Representatives, and will be going to the Senate soon. There is definitely a lot of energy being put into educating other people about what is the issue around missing and murdered Indigenous people. Why is it that Utah and Salt Lake City in the top 10 of 71 cities that were studied? Now, having those conversations with individual elected officials and representatives, you know, when you're at the legislature during session, you're lucky if you get 5 minutes. And these conversations for us have been a job that we've done full time in educating people about the issue. In particular, not only the issue itself, the missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit, but also the broader issue, which we are tasked with as an agency that is 100% supported by the U.S. Department of Justice. We are tasked with looking at domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, teen dating, which is this month, and how those intersections lead to missing and murdered Indigenous people.
Because they're connected?
There are connections. There are absolutely connections to violence that is happening not only on the reservation or in Indian country in Utah, but also violence against our urban Indian populations in the city.
And that's really the way that we've been talking about it with legislators here in Utah, is really talking about all the different pathways that lead to murdered missing Indigenous. Because in that way, we can talk to individuals whose concern is about trafficking. Yeah. And we can link how trafficking from a native community can, as a pathway to becoming murdered or going missing. We can talk about domestic violence and lethality rates around domestic violence. We can talk about sexual violence and how 2 out of every 3 Native women will be attacked in their lives, or 4 out of 5 LGBTQ within the next 6 months will be attacked. And we can show, at least with anecdotal information right now, to point out,
Here's the pathway. But are they following you on the pathway?
Are
they with you?
They are with us on the pathway, because when we talk about it in sort of these larger abstract terms of like murder, the thing that they focus on is who is the perpetrator and how do we stop it?
Yeah.
And we want to take a step back and say it's not just a single perpetrator. There are systemic structural issues that lead to that support these pathways. And we have to address those.
I love how you put it. Sorry, I just wanted to say one of the things that Moroni mentioned to us, and I love how he puts it, is you've got to move backwards to understand the pathways so you can trace them forward, I guess.
Right.
That's the way forward. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes. One of the things that – the reasons why the task force is being proposed is to study the systems that are currently in place that illustrate that there is this disparity that is happening. While we had the report that came out of Washington State that names us as in the top 10, we need to take a deeper dive, because those figures that were initially given a couple years ago have increased. But we're not seeing it in the data. The public data isn't illustrating that. And so the task force will have the responsibility of looking deeper in the systems that are currently in place, like the criminal justice system, like social services. We've got a medical examiner who will be on board potentially. And it really is understanding how when an individual goes missing, what kind of resources are available to the family, and how is that tracked through the system, through the police local police department, the sheriff's office, the Utah Highway Patrol, the medical examiner from the state of Utah. Mm-hmm. And one thing that we have that report for out of Washington State did say is that you have individuals who are going missing and murdered, specifically murdered, who are going misclassified. So when they are, there's a classification
that says. Say more
about that,
because that's really interesting.
Yes, right. The classification that is being designated is white many times.
Yeah.
And the tribal affiliation, particularly, I can tell you that I'm an American Indian or Native American, but often when people, what they are not doing is classifying the tribe. What tribe are these individuals from? We have over 500 tribes in this country, and I think that it's really important if we are going to get clear data that we need to start listing tribal affiliation.
And that's really one of the objectives of the task force, is really to address the current state of the data management and infrastructure system of law enforcement in the state of Utah. Because what we see is just the status quo in terms of data, of just basic data entry. There's a category, and that category is by default white.
Yeah.
And oftentimes what we'll find in multiple reports is race not identified. And so what that ends up doing with the actual policy practical implication of that is like, oh, there is no crime that's happening against Native people because there is nothing captured.
And so we don't know the numbers, do we?
We don't know precisely what the numbers are. The most that we know about the state of Utah in terms of the homicide rate about domestic violence came out in 2008. And that was the Native Americans, and there's no distinction based on sexual orientation or gender or whatever, says that Native Americans are victims of domestic violence-related homicide five times more than white individuals in the state of Utah.
So if you don't understand all of those dynamics, you can't really address the issue properly, can you?
No.
Why is Utah in the top 10? Any idea? Is there something about the place? Is there
that's
something?
What the task force is going to discover.
Yeah,
There will be we're hopeful that there will be a mandate that says why. That's the big question, is why is this situation look the way it is? And actually, it's much worse, in fact. And the task force responsibility will be to look at and understand those systems that are currently in place that are not giving us the accurate figures.
I wonder, you must feel hopeful. I mean, President Trump began a task force. The Trump White House began a task force. You're seeing that throughout the states. I mean, how do you feel about those, what you're seeing?
Well, I am cautiously optimistic, in part because, one, it is now receiving attention and space within the national consciousness, and people are beginning to talk about it
in places you wouldn't expect.
Right, maybe. And in places we wouldn't expect. Additionally, there is a sense of compassion and even a sense of urgency among some lawmakers. Like, why is this happening? We need to do something about it. But these task force, I'm cautiously hopeful. In part because it's going to shed light on some of these very systematic and structural concerns that we're concerned about, and how that ends up perpetuating this crisis and sometimes maintaining it. And oftentimes these are some very benign things, like a very simple research methodology of how we construct a data point. And oftentimes that tends to then erase a whole series of violent crimes, or categorize in specific types of crimes in specific ways. And so what we're hoping is this task force will say, hey, state of Utah, here's your data infrastructure system. This is where you're missing. Here's what you can do to improve to now capture and get better data. Or, hey, state of Utah, if you partner with tribes in these strategic ways, perhaps you can start sharing data with each other to address this crisis. Or, hey, state of Utah, your law enforcement needs improvement. We've found these organizations and we've identified areas of improvement around this issue, and you can get workshops and training on them. And so that's what we're sort of hoping for. And at least right now, our work with the Department of Public Safety, with Chief Ryan Redd, with the State Department of Investigations, has been very, very, very good. And we've been very hopeful with them. And their work with us has they've helped carry this bill for us as well.
Any resistance from law enforcement? It sounds like not. I mean, it sounds like they – or are you getting that? Because it does seem like that can be part of the problem. These are complicated jurisdictional issues, but those relationships are complicated too.
Right. And so we've been working with state law enforcement and the county sheriffs for about 18 months and providing them a lot of education and awareness and working through and walking them through a lot of the difficulties around jurisdiction, a lot of the difficulties with their own data collection systems.
Are they responding? You're so careful here. I get it, which I understand you have to be, but are they responsive?
They are now, and they are fully supportive of the work that we are doing.
And in fact, spoke at the last public hearing in support. So we're very, again, back to the hopefulness. We're pulling for the hopefulness. Absolutely. We couldn't do it alone. Moroni and I are the only ones employed at our little nonprofit. And but we know that those relationships are opening up.
Right. What's happening among the tribes? Are they responsive? Because that's another part of this that's important, of course.
Absolutely. Each of the tribes in the state of Utah have been 100% on board in supporting this bill and have expressed that repeatedly also with other elected officials at the Capitol.
Right. So $40,000, do you think that's enough?
No.
No, it's not. But
I think it's pennies. It's a start.
It is a start. Yeah.
For sure. Absolutely. I think that, you know, Doug, one thing I wanted to just quickly mention is that we have over 70% of Native American populations living in urban settings. And I think that as we go forward, we need to consider that those individuals, those original inhabitants of this state exist. We are here. We are among you. We are thriving. We are hurting. We are healing. And this is, I've been living in Utah for over 30 years, and honestly, I know that the state of Utah can do better when it comes to serving our Native American populations. We have good people on the Hill.
And you sound like it's happening. I mean, you sound really, I have to say, you both sound pretty optimistic in spite of some really drastic, terrible
stories. It hasn't
been
without its obstacles and challenges, but we are hopeful that Utah and the legislative elected officials are doing the right thing and really, in the end, bringing healing back to our Native communities. And that's what this is really about.
Moroni Benally, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Doug.
And Yolanda Francisco-Nez, thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER. Our intern is Natu Tway, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Tim Slover, and Ali Vallarta. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.